Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. You know, I've been doing these interviews for some time now, and with very few exceptions, when I approach someone about doing an interview, they always say they don't have a story interesting enough. And yet, I'm always truly amazed at the life stories our members share during our short time together. The same is true for our guest this month. Cliff Brown tells us an amazing story of how a single event in his childhood led to a lifelong fascination with aviation, which ended up compelling him to get his private pilot certificate, along with the combination of using that certificate throughout his work life. Believe it or not, he tells us a great story about how his ability to fly an airplane saved the world from a meltdown disaster. Once again, we conclude the podcast as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, including updates on meetings and events. Please, if you are enjoying these podcasts, click that subscribe button now. Doing so helps to keep this podcast available to our members and others. More importantly, it will help you know when a new podcast is available. We'll be right back with our guest, Cliff Brown. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and in studio today with me, I have Cliff Brown. Welcome to the studios, Cliff.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
Well, Cliff is a short-term member of EA Chapter 84, but I would have to say that you've made quite an impression and have been very involved in the short time that you've been with us. I know you've been to a couple Young Eagle rallies that you've participated in, and on this cold, rainy, north, wet day we have here, I doubt we're going to get any Young Eagles flown this weekend, but who knows, right? Who knows? Mm-hmm. So, Cliff, kind of tell our audience a little bit about your history. Where were you born and where did you grow up at?
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Palo Alto, California.
Interesting.
In 1957. And my dad had just graduated from Cal Poly and was working a job in that area. And, well, that's where I was the firstborn.
Okay.
So, have a brother and a sister also.
Any interest in aviation with them?
None.
Absolutely, sir.
Absolutely none.
Dad, yeah. Any interest in aviation?
Dad, yes.
Oh, okay.
A little complicated in that he got his student, he worked his way up to student solo, but never finished it.
Oh.
In 40 years, he never finished it.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right, so yeah. Back on track.
You're back on track. He worked for Wells Fargo Bank, and then his major goal though was to get in back into farming and ranching. He was a cowboy when he was young.
Oh, I see.
And so we got about a 200-acre ranch where we had row crops, orchards, walnuts, and almonds, and we also ran cattle in the foothills.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we were starting from a young age. You know, I was busy irrigating fields, driving tractors,
working on those tractors. I would imagine
bulldozers. I was doing arc welding.
Yeah,
everything.
Fun.
By the time I was, 8 years old, and then we would also gather cattle in the mountains and do all the cowboy stuff too. So a very agricultural, farming, ranching lifestyle for the first sort of 16 years, or actually about 15 years.
So yeah. All the way up through high school then maybe?
Yeah, all the way up through high school. The one, interesting thing perhaps is that my dad met my mom in France. He was in the Army, and he met my mom in France at a PX where he was buying something. They ended up getting married in France, and my mom came back. She's 100% French.
Oh.
And
so did you end up speaking some French with her? And
oh, yes.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Well, what actually happened, which may be of interest, is that my mother wanted us to know our French family.
Why wouldn't she?
So starting from 3 years old, she flew us, and that would be like 1960. I wonder what what planes were flying across to France at that time.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think they were prop airliners.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The Connies, probably, most likely.
Yeah. 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 And in fact, on my first flight to France, there was an engine failure taking off on the East Coast, and they had to come back. And we were put on another airplane, probably a Connie, like you said, and then we flew back to...
Now, was she flying with you on these flights, or were
yes,
you...
Yes, it was my mother and I.
Oh, great.
And my dad often would not go because of his work.
Right.
Yeah. And so my mother would go in the early years with me because my brother and sister were younger. And so, yeah, I was in France at 3 years old after flying there, which is probably back in the 60s, what wasn't as common.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But she really, and the family back in France actually funded it because it wasn't cheap to fly in those days.
I can't imagine.
Right. But my French family owned a furniture business where they took trees from the forest all the way to furniture.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're one of the primary suppliers of all the woven straw seat chairs and pews in most of the churches in Europe or in France.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have any of that furniture today?
Yes, I do.
Oh, that's interesting.
They sent over a batch of it to their very few American relatives.
Wow. Are they still in business today?
No.
Okay.
They are passed away quite a while ago. And the business, which was three city blocks of a little tiny town called Saint-Aubin-du-Colmier in Brittany, in France, that has all been converted to a city street with their name on it.
Oh, well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and their four-story stone house with slate roof is now condos. But we used to stay in that house and rove all over it when we were kids. So. Wow. And so every couple of years, we would be flown to usually England, mm-hmm. where we would catch a train to the coast and then take the boat across to Saint-Malo. And then the family would meet us there, the French family.
Now, did anybody on the French side of the family have anything to do with aviation? Because
not until recently.
Really?
I have the son of one of my favorite cousins in France is now an airline pilot.
Oh, great.
And he's the only pilot out of more than 200 direct French relatives that I have.
Wow, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I had a couple of uncles that worked for Aerospatiale, mm-hmm. and the French aviation companies, but they weren't pilots.
They weren't pilots.
Yeah.
So now back in high school in California, was there any interest in aviation at this time? Did you have any aviation?
Actually, at about where my real, where the bug was set, mm-hmm. was, I think I've always loved aviation. And back then we just had Encyclopedia Britannicas, you know.
Right.
No internet, so you had to look through. But my dad had a friend who was in the early Silicon Valley days, who was a friend of his in college, which was Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, who was a pilot. And when I was probably about 8 years old, he flew out from the Bay Area and landed in our alfalfa field.
Oh my gosh!
With his 182. And we're talking, quite a while ago.
Right.
It was a tricycle gear, but we had some pretty good size. Our crops varied between, like corn and beets or whatever,
right,
to alfalfa, rotation crops. And so we had alfalfa going, and it had just been harvested, so it was low. And he brought his Cessna in and landed on our farm and stayed at our house. And then he offered rides, and I was the only one that took him up on it.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. And so
none of the siblings?
No, my brother and sister didn't want to do it. And
they just too young or just not interested at all?
They just weren't interested or afraid or, you know, who knows.
and but Cliff's head raising his
hand. No, I'm like, I'm on board here. And
so how long did it take you to say yes to that offer? Huh?
Instantly.
Yes.
Yeah. And my dad was all for it. So, you know, he took off from our fields and flew me around the San Joaquin Valley area there and then landed again. And the bug was set.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I had to fly. And because my dad he worked for Wells Fargo Bank at the time, and he was an agricultural appraiser, he was always gone to ranches and farms, and he was also involved in the cattle business. So from time to time, his friends would come and pick us up in airplanes, King Airs or Cessnas primarily, and take us out to different ranches, and I would go along with my dad. And he was always very interested in flying himself. And so I got a lot of flights to all kinds of, you know, landing on ranches and farms. And
oh, that's great.
And so I got a lot of, you know, like
off airport operation type stuff.
Right. One of my best friends, his dad owned huge ranches all over California and in Oregon. And he flew his son and I, who were good friends in school, to Adel, Oregon, or around Lakeview, Oregon,
okay,
in his own personal King Air, and he let me fly right seat when I was like probably about 16.
Oh, yeah. Great.
So I was flying right seat in the King Air.
Did he actually give you a lesson, so to speak? Like,
he took it off autopilot and let me play with it, you know, because I'd never had any formal lessons. Right.
Would he give you headings to follow and altitudes?
No, it wasn't. He didn't go that far.
Okay.
Because I really had no flight lessons.
Nothing whatsoever.
Right, yeah.
But that had to be a thrill at that point. Age.
But that was, it was a super thrill, of course.
Right.
And fun to have the opportunity,
right,
you know. And so I did fly around in quite a few people's airplanes up till 16, you know, like with my dad and his clients and so forth. And so I got a lot of exposure to different airplanes and landing strips and so forth.
But being able to do a cross country like that
yeah,
that is, most people, their first ride is a 10-15 minute ride,
right,
you know, and then they never see an airplane again. But to be able to do a cross country like that and experience that had to really set that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I always loved every minute of it.
Oh,
I felt very at home in the, you know, in the cockpit.
I can yeah, imagine. And that was a great airplane to do it in, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what a great cross-country ship to go do something like that in.
Yeah.
You know. So anything else during the high school? Did you at that point decide to get involved in any aviation other than?
There wasn't. We lived kind of in a, out on a ranch near the towns of Las Banas and Gustine, California. You know, but 15 miles out of town.
Okay.
So these are more rural high schools.
Right.
And there just was no aviation. There wasn't much tech, period. I mean, sure, I knew how to weld really well,
right,
and all this kind of stuff and do all the farm and ranching stuff, but not much tech. But I also belonged to the 4-H for about 7 years.
Okay.
And one of the things the 4-H did was teach us a little bit about electronics. You know, they had classes on how to build your own sort of basic crystal radio or something, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
We're talking about the early days,
right,
you know.
Right, but still, that's
but
tech.
But still, yeah, they got my bug going for tech. So I was always tearing apart, you know, the family radio and putting it back together, and the miracle was it still worked.
And
you know?
So did that lead into a college choice at that point?
Well, what happened is I graduated a year early from high school, because I just took all their hard classes first and passed my SAT scores really well and was able to graduate a year early. And I was sort of very, very independent and wanting to get out into the world.
Right.
And so I did a 6 months of like a junior college.
Yeah, like an accelerated program kind
of
thing.
Yeah, you know, just to get my sort of English up, you know, to par, and, you know, my, what do you call it, general ed.
Okay.
While I shopped around for what schools I wanted to go to, and I knew I loved electronics, so I found out about a school called DeVry Institute of Technology in Phoenix. That was offering an accelerated bachelor's, a double E, where they don't do any general ed. They just ram you through the solid.
It's a technical college, so to speak.
Right. Where you know where they graduate you with a double E. Turned out to be a very interesting experience. I had to mostly pay for everything myself, so I had to work 30 hours a week while I pulled a full load in school. And DeVry was a very difficult school at that time. We had more than 50% dropouts.
Oh my gosh!
Of the students that started, it was just brutal. I mean, they pushed you hard, and you know, so it was the early days of electronics. So you know, we were programming on hex, you know, chips and stuff. And but the good thing was toward the end of my just close to graduation, I was hired before I even graduated, which was very common at this school.
Right.
We would have hiring fairs where all these companies would come in, and I got flown to Hughes and Lockheed Martin and all these different companies who offered me jobs, you know. But one company caught my eye, Western Geophysical came there. They're the world's, at that time, they were the world's largest geophysical search company. That well, you know, that's where they map the ground for for things like oil or uranium, you know. And this is a job, I thought, this is a job that sounds like adventure, you know, as opposed to these, I would walk down these hallways at Hughes, and there's all these little offices with the engineers in them.
Right.
And I'm like, this looks boring as can be, you know. And so I talked to Western Geophysical, and they heard about my background on the farm and being independent and could work on anything. They said, you're just the person, you're the only person we're hiring from this school because you've got the background, and we think you can handle our remote overseas camps, you know. So I was the youngest person they had hired at about 19.
And what year was this?
To do the math, right?
Well, let's say 20 years after you were born.
So. So 78?
Yeah.
And in that neighborhood.
So they sent you overseas.
So what they did is I spent time in their Houston office.
Sort of learning the ropes?
Just getting acquainted with Western Geophysical. I was kind of their young punk, you know, the who was pretty good at tech. And they didn't have a lot of people like that.
Okay.
You know, that had modern technology. And so they treated me really well. And then they said, we're having a portable seismic system designed by a company in France called Sercel, one of the first truly field portable big seismic recording stations that you can move around. Because most of the time they were on ships or, you know, great big trucks and big camps that were set up. So they flew me back to France, and by that time I'd been to France, you know, half a dozen times,
right?
You know, with the family, and they used to leave me with uncles. Oh, by the way, I should mention in France, my parents would leave me with aunts or uncles for 3 months all summer.
Oh yeah,
and all I would do is speak French for 3 months. You know?
So you were really good with the language, then. You know.
Yeah, I must have survived. You know. So yeah, I was surviving with French, and of course all my cousins taught me all the curse words first. But yeah, that's how that usually works with languages.
And I've got a few curse words in a few languages myself.
Yeah.
So
anyway, this company flew me to a town called Nantes, which would happen to be in Brittany, and so I was able to visit my relatives while I was there, you know.
That worked out great.
Yeah, and so I was training at this company called Sercel, who was designing all this equipment. It was about $1 million system.
Oh my gosh.
Back then, you know. And I was the only guy being trained on it. So, you know, I was treated pretty well. The company actually rented an R5 turbo for the car that I could use between classes. So I kind of had a little fun with that, you know.
So were you looking overhead at airplanes flying overhead at this time? Was there like still an interest to go do something while you're?
Oh, absolutely. But I was kind of focused on the job.
Yeah, you're young. You got a first job.
So where they flew me, so I was constantly on airliners.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And so they flew me to Egypt. Cairo. And then when we were in Cairo, we were working on a building a whole portable camp, you know, using this portable electronics that I came with me from France.
Oh, I got you.
And we were building a camp on the outskirts of Cairo, at which point when it was done, so I was working in Cairo building cables and just building all the geophones and all the equipment that plugged into the what they call the doghouse, where all the electronics are.
I got you.
Yeah. And then we jumped out into, when we got that built, we drove the whole camp, crossed the Suez Canal, and were in the Sinai Desert.
Oh, my gosh.
Looking for oil amongst arms and bombs and still live bombs and mines and things all over the place.
Oh, you're kidding.
From about six different countries having fought battles there. And so we were dealing with our camp was parked next to tanks with their tops blown off and flipped over and just this, all the signs of war.
So what would you do if you found a mine that was still alive?
Well, we had the company hired, kind of hate to mention it, but they were called mercenaries.
Right.
Who would come in with minesweepers and clear anywhere that we had to go with our camp.
So they'd come in first.
Yeah, they would come in first.
So it wasn't like you discovered them and then...
Oh, no. We weren't qualified for that.
Yeah.
So they would haul all the anti-tank mines and all the mines to a big pit that they bulldozed. And then every day they'd throw a grenade in there or set it off and blow the whole thing up.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So one of the favorite things to do was to, they might have had a little whiskey, in the lunchroom or dinner or something like that. And then somebody would get the privilege of setting off the detonator, or throwing the grenade.
As long as they threw it.
Yeah, I won't say I did or didn't, but
there's no evidence. There's no Facebook back then, so.
But it was a pretty surreal situation anyway to be out in the middle of the Sinai Desert, as a young punk, with all this crazy stuff. And so, I saw the wrong end of AK-47s a lot.
Wow.
And I wasn't even in the military.
Yeah, you're like, I'm neutral right?
Yeah. But they wanted us there because we're looking for oil. So we had carte blanche for anything we wanted to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you were giving them something that they could go off and make money with, right? So.
And something that was very unique that most people wouldn't even think about was that they were dredging the Suez Canal at that time. And where were they pumping all this salty water?
Oh, I didn't think of that.
Into the Sinai Desert. So it turns out we thought we would have, sandy dunes and big flat dirt areas to put our geophones. No, we had 2 or 3 feet deep of hyper saline water.
Oh my God.
And so we had to build totally sealed cables that, can you imagine operating in water so salty it looks red?
No.
Yeah. And then it turns out that our great big terra-tired articulated tractors that we thought could get through 2 or 3 feet of mud and water couldn't make it 1 inch in that mud. So they sent one of our Italian mechanics and a couple of mechanics to Florida and bought 18 Florida airboats. Flew them back. We're talking late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
In, I don't know what, some kind of cargo carrier. But our camp in the middle of the Sinai Desert had Florida airboats.
Yeah, I mean, you think airboat, you think Florida swamp, not Sinai Desert.
Right. I would drive around I had to learn to operate a 235-horse Lycoming
back there, yeah.
Back then. That was what I was flying a 235-horse Lycoming with nothing more than a throttle and a stick, for the, you know,
right, for the rudders at the,
yeah,
the
for the rudders, end. Yeah. And there's no brakes, you know, so the only way you stopped one of those boats is you flipped it around and let the flat edge dig into the water.
Oh, jeez. So who maintained those engines back then? I mean,
we had mechanics that were very good at fixing anything,
right?
You know, and but yeah, the Florida airboats ran really well for the period that I was doing that, and I would haul workers out to camps. I would go out to the floating stations where I had all the electronics for recording the geophones. Occasionally, we would have to get into a new area, and there was a raised military road, and so we would, you know, water drill, set charges, and then set them off with Motorola radios and blow the roads up so we could get the airboats through, you know. And the water would flow from both sections together, and then we could keep going with the airboats. So I went one day when I had some time off, I took one of our airboats by myself and took it all the way out to the Mediterranean Ocean.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, you know, in the air, because they would
How many gallons did those things hold?
Oh, it had big tanks. And like 60 gallons.
Oh, wow.
And
so you could go someplace.
And they would go 60 miles an hour on the water. So, I went all the way out to the Mediterranean, which was only about 15 miles from where.
So now, were they burning like low lead, like avgas in those things? Or did they do
To be honest, I didn't pay much attention to that. But I'm sure they were running, you know, probably 100, you know, avgas.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But this company had a lot of money.
Right.
So they just fly in whatever is needed.
Yeah, 55-gallon drums full of,
yeah. Right. And, you know, I remember, you know, putting in our these electric-powered things in the 55-gallon drums and filling them up, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, so that was sort of an adventure.
Yeah. How long did that last? What year did you get out of there?
Well, I worked for about 2 years for the company.
Uh-huh.
And in that time, I was they moved me around to different camps that needed help. You know, once this camp got well established and that equipment got going, I trained other people on how to use it. They flew me down to Saudi and United Arab Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably went to about 5 or 6 Middle Eastern countries.
Okay.
The UAE was where I ended up had enough with the company and tired of being strafed by bombers, you know, jets coming from Iraq or whatever over my head while we're out in the desert laying geophones.
Ugh.
And blowing stuff up in Yemen, you know. It got a little hairy. And
yeah, you just decided it wasn't worth it anymore.
Yeah, I got a little tired of these ultra-remote camps that we were on.
Right.
And almost died from heat prostration.
I keep having these flashbacks of the, you know, one of my favorite Jimmy Stewart movies, The Flight of the Phoenix. And,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of where my brain is picturing you out in one of these camps out there doing this stuff.
Well, yeah. And, you know, we had to drive like Toyota pickups. You know, back then they were more like a Range Rover with a pickup bed with low tire pressure. And we had to drive everywhere in the dunes and had bulldozers that would push paths, but and personally I had to drive off, you know, the cliff faces and go down 1,000-foot slip faces.
Ugh.
You know, with the trucks and a lot of times with people in them, you know, and it's just what you did. You learned
check your underwear after you get down,
you learned how to do it, and there might have been an accident or two.
Yeah,
you know, it's a crazy environment period, because it was 140 degrees or 180 degrees inside a sand bowl during the day, and it was 30 degrees at night where it would freeze water.
Oh, wow.
In the desert. So
what an environment.
Yeah, and you had to drink 5 gallons of water a day and take salt, or else you would die.
Wow.
You know? And during that time, the one good thing that the oil research or oil search companies offered is every, you worked 3 and 1 or 4 and 2, like you work 4 weeks, six and two. You work 6 weeks, you get 2 weeks off.
Okay.
And they would give you a ticket and all your per diem to go anywhere in the world each time as part of your perks.
Gotcha.
So I flew all over the place, India, Thailand, Europe, during that period. I did a huge, because, you know, you have a company that every right. few weeks gives you a ticket to anywhere in the world.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, and they would set it all up. They just, you know, give you the ticket.
So this obviously at some point this comes to an end and you end up coming back to the States?
Yeah, I got tired and I said, I've had enough. Spent 22 hours flying back to the U.S. and let it percolate a little bit. I was back on my family ranch.
Okay.
And it was at that time, probably, I'm thinking about 1980.
Okay.
I actually went to a nearby town and started taking a couple of flight lessons.
Oh, awesome.
And I did about 7 hours of that out in a town called Modesto, California. And it's in my old logbook, which I'm still having trouble finding. but that's about when it was. And I ended up getting accepted. I decided to go back to school for something different.
Okay.
And I got accepted at Cal Poly.
Wonderful.
My dad was an alumni. Passed all their tests to go in, and I went into... I bounced around a bit and ended up in industrial engineering and the School of Business.
Oh, great.
And graduated from there in a couple of years. But the big thing that happened during that period was I got my pilot license.
Oh.
I was flying from, I was working my way through school there too. And part of my jobs is I would work out at San Luis Obispo Airport. Like helping to rebuild Moonies and other airplanes. I was helping the A&Ps.
Okay.
And it paid pretty good. And the good part was I could just use the money for lessons. And they would give me good prices to rent an airplane because I worked at the airport.
Wow.
And I knew the people. And back then, San Luis Obispo Airport was like Harvey Airfield. It was a single strip. There was no tower, nothing. Not, you know, now it's a jet port.
Right.
But back then, it was a single strip where you had to click the mic button for lights, you know,
right.
for your night flights. And so I I soloed in, I think, 11 hours.
Okay.
Yeah. And
in 172 or?
150, 152s.
Okay.
I flew both. They had both of those. And back then, spin training was just, I got trained by an ex-Navy pilot, and he was absolutely set that you had to know how to handle what he called upset conditions.
Oh, okay.
Including, and he did all kinds of crazy stuff, like making me air start an airplane, you know.
Serious?
An actual air start. You know, where you dive to get the prop running.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he was a bit of a hardcore ex-Navy pilot.
Well, I mean, that's great that he did that. It's just that, I mean, insurance-wise today, they would.
Oh, yeah.
Totally
no, I mean, they don't do anything like that. I mean, he would do things like, okay, your ailerons just failed. How are you going to steer this airplane?
Oh, wow.
And he said, you're in a high wing. What are you going to do? And so I was like, I don't know. And he goes, he unlocked the door and he starts pushing it. And the airplane starts turning.
Oh, my gosh.
He said, you could push the doors out and you can steer the airplane. And, I mean, this is literally how the guy trained me. And he made me do spins constantly. And then I would go out and practice spins endlessly, you know.
Wow.
So they were second nature to me, cross-controlled stalls, all that kind of stuff. I understood. And then I also did a few, I would rent airplanes like I rented, I was checked out on about 3 or 4 of their airplanes, like Cherokees and stuff.
Right.
And so I would fly some of my college friends up to Day with an Engineer up in the Bay Area. So I would fly up to San Jose from San Luis Obispo and then fly back at night, you know, across country. And so I was doing that stuff when I was still a pretty new pilot, you know.
Well, and that's great, though, that you're doing stuff like that rather than just putting around and getting the hours.
I mean,
you're learning the plane.
Oh, yeah. And then I would fly. I had a friend who had a wedding in the San Joaquin Valley. And so I I think I rented another low wing, Cherokee, I think, again, and took my girlfriend then, who would later become my wife, flew into a ranch in San Joaquin Valley, and we had the wedding and a party, and everybody thought it was so cool that I flew in and landed in a dirt field, you know, next to the event. Well, there was one complication. 10 o'clock at night, I have to go back to San Luis Obispo.
And you can't drink while you're partying.
Well, I hadn't been drinking.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, but you can't do that. So
there was one little complication. It was a dark night. I'm on a dirt field in the middle of the valley.
No lights.
No lights.
Yeah.
So what they did is they grabbed a whole group of people that were at the wedding. They all lined up their vehicles along the runway.
Awesome.
Or actually wasn't a runway, right. Just a field. But they lit the field up.
They gave you a runway with lights.
They gave me a runway with lights. I took off. And then, you know, frankly, I had to use the wing levelers. I mean, I wasn't instrument certified, but there was the occasional light here and there crossing the coastal range.
Right.
But I used the wing leveler, for sure, you know.
Yeah, why not?
As you probably know, dark nights with no lights is pretty much instrument conditions,
right. You know. Yeah, you get that spatial disorientation. Yeah,
technically, it was VFR.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway,
if you don't have a horizon line.
Right. And this is before we had, navigation was all paper and VOR and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, all those went off without a hitch with no problems and ended up graduating from Cal Poly with another engineering degree and got married
What year was this,
a girl that I met in college.
Come on, you got to impress somebody with this date.
I got married in 19, or graduated in 83.
Okay.
Yeah. I got my pilot license in 83, graduated in 83, and got married in 83.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Busy year.
Yeah, it was a busy year. And sold everything we had kind of and took my wife on a 40-day train tour all over Europe.
Oh, my gosh.
And then we were completely broke, you know. and then that's where we threw just about everything we had in a small, whatever I had at the time, a Celica GT or something.
Right.
And we drove to Washington.
Just because?
Just because. I wanted to get out of hot California, you know. And had a couple of people I knew up here and struggled a bit. You know, lived on Ballard Street in Seattle.
Right.
You know, while I delivered phone books and whatever, as you do before you get a job. And, that's how I ended up in the Pacific, Northwest.
So what was your first real job here then?
Well, I chanced onto an oddball job on Vashon Island.
Okay.
For a tofu factory. Yeah. And it's still in operation today. It's called Island Springs. And they were trying to develop with a Danish company and a Swedish company, we're trying to develop a new method of soy protein extraction. And I was the guy hired to be the engineer to help to create this stainless steel equipment, reverse osmosis system for food proteins, and things like that.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I ended up having to fly to Denmark and to Sweden to meet with these companies. And we, were buying these equipments. We had some investors that came into the tofu company. They were renting a facility when I started with them in a place called Wax Orchards, which if you know Vashon Island, it was a fruit jellies and things like that. There was orchards, Wax Orchards. It's called Wax Orchards on Vashon Island. And they had an airstrip. So I would rent airplanes at Tacoma Narrows and then come and land on Vashon Island at Wax Orchards or at Vashon Municipal, which is a grass strip. And Wax Orchards was a dirt strip.
So how close was Wax Orchards in comparison to the grass strip of Municipal there?
About 6 miles.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was I don't want to say considerable, but it was a distance.
Yeah. And Wax Orchards was, of course, private.
Right.
You couldn't land there unless you knew the owners.
Right.
Yeah. It's Wax Orchards still exists. The owners since died. Mm-hmm. I think they're now developing it. The airstrip is, the old dirt strip is still there, but you can't use it.
Yeah, it's probably, and, it just hasn't been maintained.
Well, they might turn it into an air park.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the rumor I've heard. Anyway, Vashon Municipal is still there and
right.
has hangars, and it's still a grass strip. Yeah, and, mm-hmm. and I still fly there to visit my friends, you know. Land on that strip, and then they come and get me.
They need to mow it more often.
Yes, yeah. So that was, I lived on Vashon for 12 years. And my kids were born there, had property there that I developed. And again, I was developing all this test equipment. Wax Orchards had a fire at their plant, which destroyed most of our equipment.
Oh my gosh.
We were renters, but they had a fire that came over into our side.
What year was this?
That was probably 85.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in that neighborhood, 1985. And so I was tasked with building a new plant, which, as it turned out, was right behind the K2 factory on Vashon. We got property there, and I worked with contractors and built an all-new plant in about 60 days. And that plant's still operating today. But it was quite the flurry, and did all the systems, electrical, hydraulic, steam plant generators, packaging machines, you know, the whole soy process line, as well as all the new test equipment. And so anyhow, during that whole time, when I could afford it, I was renting airplanes at Tacoma Narrows. And a couple of times I flew people all around the Puget Sound. One time they wanted to look at all the coastline in the Puget Sound area because they wanted to have nori farms. So I rented, I forget which model, 172 with long-range tanks,
mm-hmm.
and would fly them, spend hours in the air flying all the coastline of the Puget Sound.
Wow.
And so they could scope out, where they might want nori farms, you know, seaweed farms.
Okay.
Yeah. And then
you're still pretty active then doing your aviation
at this point.
I mean, you're managing to kind of interweave it a little bit with your lifestyle.
Yeah, one of the funny parts is when Island Spring developed their first soy ice cream,
mm-hmm.
the product was made in Tacoma. I went and got it with a pickup, and I was coming back, and the ferry went down. The South End Ferry of Vashon. Mm. It was a hot day. And I got a load full of the first batch of ice cream in the back. I was like, what am I going to do?
Start eating?
I drove to Tacoma Narrows, grabbed one of their, I think, 172s, I think, shoved all the ice cream onto the airplane, landed at Wax Orchards. This was before the factory burned.
Uh-huh.
And taxied up to the factory and delivered the ice cream to our freezers.
Oh my god!
In an airplane.
And what a great idea. What a great opportunity to use aviation in an emergency,
and the company even paid for the airplane.
Oh my god!
That was pretty awesome. And, you know, what? We got enough notoriety that actually, I think it was Cairo or one of those local
news agencies,
the news agencies, flew their Bell Jet Ranger out to our factory and interviewed us. And then I got the pilot to give me, he flew me around in his Bell Jet Ranger for a while and let me try it, you know, from Vashon Island.
What a great opportunity.
Yeah, it just happened to happen, you know. And so aviation managed to sneak in, you know.
It's a great thing to have in your back pocket when you need it, right? What a great way to just, you know, hey, pull out a little trick now and then. I can take this airplane and save the day.
Well, they thought it was the coolest thing they'd ever seen.
Right.
You know, that I delivered ice cream in an airplane.
Of course.
You know.
What a story.
And I would take my wife and my kids when they were quite young. You know, we're talking like three and four. Take them out to Tacoma Narrows and then fly them all around, you know. So they got early exposure to aviation, but neither of my daughters got the bug.
Really?
Yeah.
So you have two daughters?
I had two daughters on Vashon Island. Yeah.
And what are they doing now?
My oldest daughter, about 2 years ago, got her doctorate from UW.
Oh my gosh, great.
In the not clinical side, but the mental or psychiatric side.
Got it.
And she's practicing now, insanely busy, but also had four kids.
Oh, jeez.
So I have three granddaughters and a grandson.
Well, it sounds like you got some work to do flying some grandkids around.
I already have flown my. I flew my grandson when he was 4 years old.
Oh my gosh!
From Harvey Field.
Set that bug early.
Oh, he's got it bad. I think he's my successor.
Yeah. Hey, Grandpa. So, tell me how you ended up then. So you're Vashon. How do you end up?
Okay, so Vashon Island. Sadly, after about 14 years, my wife and I then parted ways.
Okay.
Very complicated why, of course, like most of those things.
Right.
And I got divorced in about 95.
Okay.
It was the best at that time to sort of leave the island, and I managed to get a job in the Bellevue area at a company called MicroStar, who did electronics.
Okay.
Electronic boards for data acquisition and things like that. And of all things, I ended up working in their sales department as their OEM sales manager.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I actually forgot to mention, on the 12 years I was on Vashon, the tofu thing had a kind of a financial problem for quite a while, and I had to look for another job. And I found a job in programming, because I had done a lot of programming for all the test equipment for the factory. I had to learn a lot of programming then. And I was learning to program Fortran 5 when I was in Cal Poly. But I ended up working for about 7 years as a programmer for transportation modeling simulation software.
Wow.
Which is still in use today. But that got weird, and with the divorce, and I ended up leaving the island and working at this other place.
Okay.
And it was a good job in Bellevue, and I ended up meeting another woman who was also going or had gone through a divorce as well.
Okay.
And so anyway, one of those kind of stories. But it's all worked out. We've been married almost 28 years now.
Great.
And so she had a son who was quite young when we got married, and he's now 6'5", and
and still growing.
And still growing, and likes airplanes. So I might set the bug with him too.
Oh, great.
Yeah, but he's into computers.
Yeah. Seems to be a common theme these days.
Right.
A lot of kids doing that.
So, yeah. So that's a little bit of the background.
So you ended up out in Bellevue.
End up in Bellevue. And one of my customers as an OEM sales was one of the original founders of the company, MicroStar, but went his own way when he and the other principal had, disagreements.
Right.
He wanted to do something else in technology,
okay.
Namely everything networked.
The
original owner didn't want to. This was the early days of networking, of Ethernet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was my client, and so we started talking, and he was trying to get this business going, and this is like 97.
Okay.
We just got to talking, and he said, I really need somebody that understands like a kind of a wide range of mechanical and how to build stuff like a manufacturing line and all that. I says, well, as a matter of fact, and I ended up interviewing with him in his at his house, and he was building something in his garage. A very genius guy in terms of programming and things like that. he had written a couple of operating systems that were being used on these boards that MicroStar sold. And I hit it off with the two principals, one who was a Canadian. He was originally a Canadian, but the owner was naturalized in the U.S.
Gotcha.
And, you know, married an American girl. Anyhow, he and I got the first office, 180 square feet in downtown Bellevue in the California building on the ninth floor. And I built the first system for the company in that office.
Wow.
And yeah, it's there's a lot of history there because I've been there almost 28 years. And we've built it up to where we have a 17,000 square foot building in Kirkland. And to this day, I still operate, do the mechanical engineering. In the early days, of course, I wore all the hats.
Yeah, when you're small,
I did sales and internet design and actually, so I would sell the systems and then build the systems.
Right.
So, a very interesting job. A lot of travel involved with that, going to all these launch range facilities and flight test ranges and everything that we build equipment for. So everywhere up and down the east and west, the east and west coast launch ranges and things.
Well, let's pivot a little bit.
Yeah.
And let's go to, hit it right on the head with your aviation. Tell everybody what you're flying right now and how you came about purchasing the airplane. And why you made that choice of that airplane.
Sure. Well, all this that I was telling you on Vashon, my flying stopped in basically 1995.
Okay.
Because financial reasons. I couldn't afford to rent airplanes at that time,
mm-hmm.
As you might imagine. So I had a pretty good rusty pilot period.
Okay.
From 95 until, I think it was 2021. My wife said, you need to get back into flying. So I had support.
Yeah.
And
that's a big thing too. Having that support is a huge thing.
Yeah. And we were at a position in life where we could do it.
Right.
And so I said, she said, you need to get an airplane. Can you imagine your wife telling you that? You need to get an airplane.
I can, but I know that others do not understand that.
Yeah.
I'm lucky that my wife will do that. But I know exactly what you mean. There are some relationships where that support isn't there.
Right.
And it makes it very difficult.
Right. And so I shopped around. I even looked at Vashon Aircraft.
Right.
Almost bought one. Started looking at actual costs, insurance.
Right. Right.
What do annuals cost? Ooh, certified airplanes, expensive. And started looking at the experimental market,
mm-hmm.
which I've always loved. I have to say, during my rusty pilot period, it wasn't like I wasn't doing things in the air. I was a skydiver. I did paragliding.
Okay.
I got trained on paramotoring. If you're familiar with that.
You're still scratching the itch.
I was still up in the air.
Right.
Yeah. Either throwing myself out of airplanes or gliding around on paragliders.
Okay.
So hadn't given it up completely.
Mm-hmm.
But, my wife thought, those things were, let's just say, first they were solo, I couldn't mm-hmm. take her, and they were dangerous or more dangerous.
Right, right.
And so she's like, you need an airplane so that we can share this, And there was ulterior motivation.
Flying and making flying social is such a great way to do it.
Absolutely.
It's just a great social way to get to know people.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got lucky and hit, trade a plane and Barnstormers and every other thing and got lucky. And I found an airplane in Bremerton Airport. A couple there had a Zenith CH-750 Stoll. That they were upgrading to a slightly faster airplane because they had to do longer cross countries regularly. And frankly, the Zenith Stoll airplane's not extremely fast.
No.
And so they sold it to me for a good price. And I found a local CFI with a lot of bush flying who actually worked for Glassair as a test pilot, owns a Sportsman. Is that their high wing, Glassair?
Yeah.
Was the test pilot for that. So he had about 1,000 hours of bush flying, if you will.
Okay.
And was willing to teach me the...
Right.
Or get me, you know, requalified.
Right.
Basically just had to do a flight review.
But he's going to
but also be
focus
checked,
on that.
But also be checked out in that airplane, which he had never flown either.
Oh, you know, okay.
It's hard to find these special, you know, sort of specialty, you know, experimental aircraft, like an RV or something.
Right.
So, but again, it's all about insurance, you know, at least for me. He was able to fly 5 hours with the previous owner, you know, learn the airplane.
Right.
Then fly it by himself for 5 hours, and then he could teach me in it. And the insurance company accepted that.
Great.
And off we went to the races. And probably about 25 hours into it, he's just like, okay, you know.
You're on your own.
You're ready to rock.
You've proven it to me that you can do it. And
take your airplane and go have fun. And so... a very good instructor, if we're allowed to name names.
Of course
you
are. Yeah,
his name is Jake Apple.
Okay.
Yeah, and a young guy, but very, very good pilot.
Great.
Yeah.
And he's local here?
Yeah, he's actually based at Monroe.
Oh, great.
First Air. He has a hangar there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how are you enjoying the plane?
Well, I've had nothing but fun with that airplane. And the first, you know, one of the main things I discovered is the Zenith 750 has almost unparalleled visibility from the cockpit. It's almost like a helicopter.
Wow.
It has bubble doors on both sides and a great big windscreen and an overhead clear, what do you call it?
Over your head.
Yeah, over your head. And so you see everywhere. And so taking people up for sightseeing was one of my favorite things to do.
Oh, yeah.
So I took up family, relatives, and friends, and I've flown everybody from 4 years old to 90 years old.
And seeing that amazement on their face is such a reward.
And the amazement is the biggest reward ever.
Yeah.
And then I joined the EAA club.
Mm-hmm.
I'd actually been an EAA member for a long time, but never been to a chapter.
Right.
And so I joined the Chapter 84, and... just a great group of people.
Yeah, they are.
And I met some people there, and everybody was so friendly and helpful. And then I learned about the Young Eagles, so I promptly signed up for that. And since flown maybe 10 or more kids.
Well, so, thank you for doing that.
So far, and I'm still working on it.
Yeah. You know, it's a great reward, though, to see the kids that... the enthusiasm, the excitement when they get in that cockpit.
Yes, I have to say that the smiles on their face and their excitement is an amazing reward.
Oh yeah,
you know it's worth everything.
Pay it forward.
Yeah,
and just you know give as much back as you can because you might fly 20 kids and out of those 20 kids, one is going to take it forward. But we need aviators.
Yes. And in fact, I've taken up a couple of kids, if you want to call them kids, that were 17 years old. And one of them's already starting flight lessons.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I would consider that one a success.
I would consider that.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you on that. Absolutely agree on that. So what's some of the adventures you've done with this plane? Have you done anything that it was meant to do?
I'm still fairly new to the airplane.
Okay.
I won't pretend, you know, like I feel confident to go diving down deep mountain canyons, you know, like 5 hours away from civilization. But I have landed on gravel bars on the local rivers, the Stillaguamish and the Skagit, for example.
Oh, sounds fun.
Yeah. I've landed really crazy little airstrips that I've gotten permission to land from.
Right.
Like Eliza Island,
okay.
You know, which is micro tiny island with ocean on both ends of the runway, you know. So I like to find really fun runways to land, you know, off pavement runways. And so I've done a bunch of them all around. I've landed Skycomish and, you know, been flown up the valleys and landed at, you know, Darrington and Concrete, mm-hmm. and then I've landed at Green Valley, which is basically farm fields, you know. And so, yeah, I try to find fun airstrips to fly in and out of. I also do the $100 hamburgers with people, you know, where we fly to different, you know,
right.
Jeffco or Thunfield, or, you know, we'll fly down and have a burger.
What's the furthest you've gone in it?
Haven't gone super far. Thunfield was probably about as far as I've gone with it.
Okay.
With no issues. I'm still a bit tentative on taking, you know, like Stehekin is my goal.
Right.
Okay. And I have friends that are also on the other side of the Columbia River there, you know, by Ellensburg,
right.
who want me to fly and see them. So I'm going to get brave enough here pretty soon, probably this next summer, to fly over the mountains.
Well, we can make it a flight of two. I'd be more than happy to follow you.
Sure. Yeah. And I have a couple guys that will do it with me, too.
We can
too.
Make a gaggle going over the mountains.
Yeah, and I would rather do it that way.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to by myself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. Even though with today's modern electronics and ADS-B stuff, but having somebody there along with you is just that comfort factor.
So. Yeah, and I have all that in my airplane, you know, ADS-B and everything, and that's so wonderful compared to when I started flying.
Oh, yeah. Back paper charts and
folding
things.
Yeah, what's that?
Oh,
you know?
EA6B out and all that fun.
yeah, all that stuff's gone.
Gone.
Yeah, it's gone in history. But, you know, one of the fun things about you know, the airport, for example, Harvey is a wonderful airfield.
Oh, yeah.
And so much activity. And one of my hangar mates had an RV-8, you know, aerobatic airplane. He's a doctor at UW, but, you know, I gave him an air Uber in my plane a couple times when he was having his airplane fixed and stuff. And so he's like, oh, you can fly my airplane. So we went up in it. It's kind of fun to fly at 200 miles an hour down the, you know, up Highway 2, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all the way to the pass and back at 220 miles an hour, you know.
Get someplace.
Yeah. And then on the way back, he let me do a couple aileron rolls.
There you go.
Yeah. The one thing I forgot to mention is that when I got my pilot license, my Navy instructor said, uh-huh. I want you to take 15 hours of aerobatics right after this.
Oh, wow.
Before you go anywhere else flying. So I took his advice, and I went down to a town called Santa Maria that was close to San Luis Obispo. Uh-huh. And in a super decathlon, I took 15 hours of aerobatics.
Wow.
So I knew how to loop and roll and, you know.
Yeah, and just having that in your back pocket is a great comfort, knowing that you've been there.
It's been, from then on, I felt much, much more.
Right.
Even though he had run me through crazy stuff, that was the aerobatics was very important, and I would recommend it to anybody who can fit that into their schedule, is to get some aerobatics time. I think it's very, very valuable. Because if you get caught in a rotor at a big airport, you know, and you get tipped over 90 degrees or more, it's kind of nice to just, with reflexes, just roll it all the way around.
Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, just keep going.
Yeah.
And a lot of people would just freak out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So aerobatics is very well worth it. And I found out that even after a long, rusty period, I was still able to do aileron rolls in an RV-8 without much trouble.
It's a great airplane.
It's a great flying airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It just rolls so easy.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
But
that center line, being on that center line just makes it so much easier. And,
but the big thing was to meet people around you and who's just sharing their airplanes, you know, and their time and their hangars and their advice.
It's a great family to be in.
It's the best group of people ever. So
along those lines, let's say you had a little bit of moment with one of your young eagles and you wanted to give him a little bit of advice going forward, you know, what kind of advice would you give a young eagle or a young child today that showed an interest in aviation, not necessarily a pilot, but just aviation? Maybe it's somebody that just wants to be around the aviation world.
What
would you say to them?
I absolutely have had those questions.
Okay.
And what I tell them is if you're really driven to be in the air, you know, here's what you have to do. And this is roughly what it's going to cost and the time it takes. there's several avenues towards it, like the military, mm-hmm. you know, or if you can afford it, private. But I said, you can also, if you want to be still around airplanes and working with them, there's all kinds of wonderful jobs in aircraft maintenance mm-hmm. and design. And so those are the kind of the avenues that I point people at, is, you know, like A&Ps or you know, sort of aviation-related maintenance.
Yeah, I think all too often people think aviation, they think they have to be the pilot. But in today's world, the pilot does very little.
Yeah.
I mean, even less than they did, you know, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, they had to know
their airplane.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because if it was, they had to land on an airport, they had to fix it.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and now they land and they throw the logbook to the maintenance officer and walk away, right?
Where I'm from, the old school, where I have to know my airplane top to bottom,
right.
engine too. And of course, in the experimental field, you can do it.
Right.
You know, and which is wonderful for me because I like that.
Yeah.
I like the working on the airplane almost as much as the flying.
Yeah. And if a young kid just wants to be around that aviation, there's nothing wrong with it.
No.
Becoming an A&P, you can make a good living.
Yeah, yeah. I told him, I said, there's a good living to be had and in high demand.
Especially right now.
Yeah.
Huge demand for A&P.
Right. And so I said, it's a very good path. And, you know, one thing to realize is that if you're an A&P, you'll make good money. You'll get very experienced with airplanes. And guess what? If you buy an airplane and get your pilot license, you can work on your own airplane.
You can work on your own airplane.
Which is a huge benefit.
That's
right.
That's one of the reasons why I got my IA, was that exact reason.
Right.
Was to be able to work on my own plane.
Right.
And, I mean, it's, as an A&P and an IA, I don't work for an operation that does that, but Dynon has an aircraft fleet that I maintain, and so I can use that towards that, and still,
yeah,
I'm not out working in the cold, wet weather, but it's a great way to make a living. You can use it as such a tool to have in your toolbox.
Yeah, absolutely, and that is kind of the advice, if you will, that I give to these. Now, the real young folks, they have a ways to go before they'll get to any of those paths.
Right.
And who knows what the aviation field will be in 10 years. But, you know, I still, you know, a lot of them just love going up in the air.
Well, to kind of build on your comment there, 10 years, where do you think aviation's going? Do you think we're going to have the high demand for pilots and aviation another 10, 20 years? Do you think it's going to grow, or do you think it's going to start to wane with all the drones? And
well, honestly, the world doesn't seem to be making any less people, mm-hmm. so there's just going to be more and more population. I think the demand for flight, you know, especially airlines and so forth, mm-hmm. people transportation, is going to keep growing. I don't think it's going to fully automate for a long time. I think for liability reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit hard to predict because there's also the whole world of electrification, you know, as battery tech gets
right.
better, you know, whether it's going to go to, you know, quote, battery powered airplanes. It's not there yet.
No.
And it won't be for a while.
No, energy density just isn't.
It just
enough.
Isn't there.
No.
Yeah. But there's all kinds of things that could happen. But just going along the same track we are now, I think it's only going to increase.
So you think there's going to be more demand for
I think there's, at least for the next 10 plus years, there's going to be demand for pilots.
Right.
And
do you think general aviation is going to follow that too? Do you think general aviation is...
General aviation is a hard one.
Right.
I think it is waning, mostly because of costs.
Right.
And I don't think it was ever cheap to fly, you know, relative to the time period.
Right.
But it was more accepted and accessible, you know, back in the 50s, for example, where you know, it was, you know, in the news and everything else. Now it's not.
Right.
Other than accidents.
Well.
Yeah.
It bleeds, it leads.
Right.
So.
So, yeah, I, you know, that's why I think it's part of my duty to help expose the young generation
and to sort of mentor them to do that
to flying. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate that. Hey, Cliff, this has been an absolutely wonderful and interesting interview. I always come in here just wondering where it's going to go, and I'm always leaving amazed at the stories our members have to tell. And you, along with just about everybody I've ever done these interviews with, always tells me, oh, I don't have much to say. And yet we sit down here and the time goes so fast because the stories are so interesting. I really appreciate you coming in, sharing your story, and I hope it encourages more to sit down with me and talk. Thanks for coming down here.
Well, thanks a lot, Dave. I appreciate it.
And now the news for January 2024. The chapter is still looking for a few more members to step up and help with some of the work that needs to be done throughout the year to keep the chapter going. You could volunteer as little as 1 to 2 hours a month to help out, or if you think you can pay it forward a little more, we have needs for members who are willing to give 3 to 5 hours a month. If you are interested in these opportunities, simply contact one of the current club officers for more information. Their contact information is located on our website. Speaking of commitments to the chapter, we officially have a new president, someone you should be familiar with, as I have interviewed her in episode 20 of this very podcast. Eileen Borkman has stepped forward to serve in this critical position for the chapter. In addition to Eileen, Jeff Raker has stepped up to take over the newsletter editor position. I'm sure the chapter is going to benefit immensely with our new volunteers. I'm also sure I can speak for all of the members in thanking the two of you for volunteering your time. Well, unless you have been living under a rock for the past month or not at all interested in experimental aviation, you have most likely heard about the financial crisis Vans Aircraft is in and their filing for Chapter 11 protections. While Vans Aircraft is taking steps to stay solvent, there is a lot of work that still needs to get done. Part of that work included a significant price increase averaging about 30% on kits and parts. The company is also trying to fulfill the vast number of back orders they have. Unfortunately for customers, Vans is requiring those customers to pay the difference in the new price before they ship their kits. Early indications are that Vans is shipping kits and parts again after a short pause during the Chapter 11 filing process. Let's hope that the company can get things in order and regain the prestige it has held in the experimental community. Our speaker this month most likely won't impress you with stories of high-speed passes, but what he does have to share is more unique than if you were to have walked on the moon. Former Goodyear blimp crew member David Readout will share what it is like to fly and travel around the country in the well-known airship and just how well the airship performs. Don't miss it. Well, since it is the new year, this means chapter dues need to be paid. So right now, open up your PayPal app and make that $20 payment to EA Chapter 84. Don't forget to put in the comments that it is for the 2024 membership dues and include your name. Well, that's a wrap for this month's podcast. Spread the word about EAA Chapter 84 podcast to your aviation friends and family. It is available for download on most popular apps, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. Make sure to hit that like button, subscribe, and give us a 5-star review. I would encourage you to go listen to previous podcasts, as there are now over 20 different interviews. I hope you remember to file a flight plan for next month's podcast. Be sure to find the latest news by following EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber. And remember, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.